that's irrelevant. So see you next. So.
Okay, sure, you come to order. It's February 3rd. The first item on today's agenda is a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3634. I'll open a public hearing. Mr. Taylor.
Members of the committee, House Bill 3634 comes to you from Representative Barker, and it, what it basically does, it extends to victims primarily the right to, of notice and to, in some cases to be heard in a notice of the results in federal habeas, in habeas corpus petitions, Court of Appeals matters, the matters before the parole board, the PSRB, and other matters like that, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, excuse me. And I just came out of Senate Veterans yesterday.
So and I'm for sorry. The people standing, there's an overflow room. They have the TV on and in room 343, if you would rather be there.
Mr. Chair, a question of counsel. Sorry, do we have a fiscal on this bill?
Chair, members of the committee, we do not have the fiscal yet. Yeah, and the dash, if I should add, too, is the dash one amendments replace the bill.
All right.
Yes.
Call up three people, if I could, Doug Baloof, Doug Harkerode, and Steve Dole.
Please remember to identify yourself for the record
and proceed in any order you'd like.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I'm with Crime Victims United of Oregon. We'd like to thank you very much for holding a hearing on this bill. The bill, I think we actually started talking about this immediately after the end of the last session, and beginning in October, we've gone through several drafts. We finally printed a bill, and now, as the chair mentioned, we have a dash one amendment that in, replaces the bill in its entirety. I just want to, for the record again, make a few comments, if I could, about victims' rights in Oregon. Almost 10 years before I was involved in this, Bob and Dee Dee Coons formed Crime Victims United out of an organization called Parents of Murdered Children when there were no crime victims' rights in Oregon. At a time when a crime victim wasn't allowed in the courtroom, wasn't allowed to speak, was almost treated as a piece of evidence. In 1984, they brought ballot measure 8 to the ballot, and it was defeated. They came back in 1986 with another measure. These were statutory measures. And that measure was passed by a wide majority of Oregonians, and there were statutory rights placed in the statutes to protect victims' rights. There was a move through the in the country at that time to move those rights for crime victims into constitutions. And in 1992, there was an attempt to place a measure on the ballot to change those rights to constitutional rights. So it failed to get on the ballot. In 1996, we were successful with Measure 40, and again was passed by a wide majority of Oregonians. Unfortunately, 2 years later, it was tossed out by the Supreme Court in Oregon based on the way it was presented to Oregonians, and we came back in 1999 and put 7 measures on the ballot through the good graces of the legislature, and 4 of those were passed and are now part of the Oregon Constitution. In 2008, there were 2 ballot measures that were placed on the ballot again by the good graces of the Oregon legislature from the 2007 session that actually gave, removed the bar in the Constitution that allows now crime victims to seek remedies when their rights are violated. And both those measures were passed in the May 2008 election. And last year, there was a bill that went through this body, Senate Bill 233, that set up the architecture, if you will, or the foundations in order for those bills to work. So that's where we are today. That's all good news, but the problem that we have or the situation that we have is this, that all of that covers everything up to the end of the trial, basically. There's some mishmash or scattered rights post-trial, but there's nothing that's that significantly codifies all the rights that a victim should have in the areas of appeals, post-conviction relief, psychiatric review board hearings, parole board hearings, et cetera. And that's what this bill sets out to do. So I'm going to do this. I brought two attorneys with me to take over. I've got Doug Arkelrod, the former district attorney of Lane County, and counsel and lobbyist for the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance, and I've got Doug Ballouf, who actually wrote this bill, and Doug is the founder of the National Crime Victims Law Institute and a professor of law at Lewis and Clark, and probably the foremost expert, not probably, the foremost expert on crime victims' rights in the country today, and we're honored to have both these gentlemen, and very glad to have had Doug help us with this bill and other issues as we move through making crime victims' rights a reality in Oregon. Thanks very much.
Mr. Chair, before we proceed, could I ask a question?
Yes.
So Bill Taylor wrote the measure summary. Was that the, it's a gut and stuff now, correct?
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, Representative Domingue, that's correct.
So the staff measure summary, was that what you wrote? Was that the Dash 1 amendment?
I hope to the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay. Yes. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I intended to be the Dash 1.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Doug Arkelrod. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney, and I currently represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance in public safety matters. Most of you know, but a few may not. I started in prosecution in 1974 in the Lane County District Attorney's Office when there were no victims' rights. I spent 10 years doing that as an assistant and became district attorney in January of 1985. The second day I took office, we opened a small victim services program to help victims of crime. I won't repeat what Steve Dole just said. I was a part of that movement. I remember the little kids who were sexually assaulted that I worked with, and I remember the victims and the elderly people, hundreds of them over those times. And those people need rights. And fortunately, the victims' rights movement has given them a whole bunch of rights, not unreasonable rights, the right to be notified when hearings occur, the right to make a statement to the judge on sentencing. Very simple things, just common courtesies that many people around the country were doing, but in some places they weren't. All right, all that said, so we have now fast forwarded 20 years, done a great job of giving victims rights up through sentencing in a criminal case. And where we need to do the next logical step, in my mind, is in after sentencing in those post-convictions areas. And as I read through the bill that Doug Ballouf wrote and the reworkings, and he's worked with so many people on it, I see those same very basic, simple rights being given to victims after the sentencing hearing. And so the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance and myself personally strongly endorse this bill, and that's all I'll say.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barton, honorable members of the committee, my name is Doug Ballouf. I was well introduced by Mr. Dole. Since the first hearing on this bill, I've had the opportunity to communicate with various government agencies that the bill has impacted. The result is a bill that's greatly improved. I would describe the bill as filling in some remaining gaps in victims' rights accommodations in the post-trial processes, as well as adult and juvenile psychiatric commitment processes. There were several things I did in response to concerns of members of this committee in the last hearing. First, provisions with significant fiscal impact were either removed or altered to eliminate fiscal impact to a minimum. For example, there is presently no immediate contact to victims for inmates who escape from the Oregon State Hospital. The first draft sought to remedy that, but it became apparent in conversations with the director of the PSRB that immediate notice would have a significant fiscal impact on that agency, which is not a 24/7 agency, but an 8-to-5 Monday through Friday agency. So, for example, that provision is withdrawn, and I've suggested to Mr. Dole he take this particular issue and a couple of others to the Attorney General's task force on victims to work through the issue and obtain support for the PSRB to come before this committee in the next session and provide the resources to the PSRB that it needs to achieve that. Second, this draft addresses comments by Mr. Barton in particular about the issue of prompt disposition inclusion. That provision has been removed. There were questions put to be about remedies. What would the remedies be? Now, it's important to understand that legal remedies don't always have to be expressly placed in a statute to have them. So in my view, a subsequent review of this draft persuades me that the remedies of reconsideration by the agency or board, the relevant agency or board, is available to victims, and that the remedy of mandamus is also available to victims. These are not typically remedies that are inserted into every statutory provision. They exist foundationally in the law. It's my view it's unnecessary to specifically articulate those remedies in this bill. I did circle back to Ledge Counsel, not Mr. Taylor, but Joshua Nasby, discussed this issue with him, and he agreed with that assessment. There's one exception in the current draft, and the exception exists because of the sensitive nature of the cases that the PSRB handles and the fact that the population it handles are people who suffer from mental illness rather than people who are incarcerated from crime. The specific remedy of reconsideration is provided in both the adult and the juvenile PSRB context. The concern is, given the sensitive population, I've concurred with the director of the PSRB that a specific identified remedy of reconsideration was appropriate there. As a result, no substantial burden is placed on the courts with these remedies because both the remedies of reconsideration and the remedy of mandamus give courts a lot of discretion, and I've had conversations about that with representatives of the courts, particularly Mr. Factor of the courts. My understanding is he concurs with my assessment there. The director of the parole board, I contacted him as well. He had certain concerns, some of which are met in this draft, some of which are not. I'd like to address the concerns that are not to the end. But perhaps the most challenging issue in the bill, the initial bill, involved local hearings on parole violations. And Mr. Taylor brought this to our attention initially in a meeting we had to work on the bill. And I circled back to local community corrections. Many of these are summary proceedings. Only a very small minority of them are formal proceedings. They happen very rapidly. They happen typically in the jail. They're typically a conversation with the parole officer and the inmate to try to resolve the violation. And it is clear to me that inserting victims' rights into that context would substantially disrupt that process and add a fiscal impact, and that that would be unwise. I would note that in talking to the head of the parole board, what I understand is that their interpretation of the current law is that the current law does, in fact, require the local agencies to provide victims' rights. So this bill actually corrects that. I was talking to Steve Dole before we came in, and I said, Steve, I can't remember a time when you and I walked into a hearing and reduced the scope of victims' rights. But what is plain to me is that in these summary disposition type of hearings, if the director of the parole board is correct and current law requires victims' rights to be applied in those, it would be extremely disruptive. It would have a significant fiscal impact. So the bill is redrafted to require notice to victims only in formal hearings, not those summary disposition hearings. And that resolved concern not only of the parole board, but of the Association of Local Parole and Probation Officers, and the Department of Corrections were all concerned about that. So that's resolved. There's a remaining issue that they have that we've agreed to resolve, if I could hold that till the end of my remarks. There were concerns by the director of the parole board that some of the proposals made in the initial bill were best handled by administrative implementation. In speaking with him, I concurred with that assessment. They were in the bill because they had not been addressed to date. I felt they should have been addressed to date. But I am comfortable with the assurance of the new director of the parole board that they will consider these issues as part of their agenda moving forward, and I think they can resolve them successfully administratively. Again, I disagree. The parole board director and I think we have a couple disagreements. I'll talk about at the end of my remarks. The courts had certain concerns. I want to address that, including who would provide notice. That is resolved. The persons providing notice are district attorneys or the attorney general, at least as concerns PSRB cases and appeals, and the PSRB itself will provide notice where appropriate. The courts themselves are not asked to provide notice. I met again with the court representative, Mr. Factor, this morning, and I understand this draft resolves the substantial concerns of the court. There is one overriding concern that the courts brought up that probably applies to everything in this legislation. I think it can be resolved through testimony today rather than amending the bill, and that is that all these rights are intended to apply prospectively only. They are not intended to go back and catch up with appeals or PSRB proceedings that are already underway or already filed. We realize that's that would be an unrealistic burden to place on agencies and courts. I've had conversations with the district attorney. I got a list from the attorney general's office revealing a variety of concerns. I believe that all of their substantive concerns have been met. At least if they haven't, I haven't heard of any more. You never know, do you? So I think the bill is in pretty good shape. There are a couple of concerns that the parole board and I disagree with at the moment. There are two provisions in the bill that I'd like to address. One is that, a little background, parole board hearings are interesting administrative hearings. They're not just administrative hearings, they're kind of unique hearings. And they're unique in the sense that historically there has only been one party present at a parole board hearing, and that party present has been the inmate. And several years ago, a law was passed giving victims certain limited rights in front of the parole board. It was passed by a vote of the people. And that allows victims to address the parole board, much as they address courts in sentencing. The tension, I think, between myself and the present director of the parole board about these particular provisions, we agree on many other things, has to do with the tension in not turning that proceeding into a trial. I think we both philosophically agree the proceeding should not turn into a trial, but my impression in now being involved in several high-profile parole board hearings is a concern about complete information, whether the board has complete information or not. It's difficult to draft language that provides the board information, of course, without making it look like it's discovery or some incremental step towards a trial process. Certainly not my intent or the intent of the bill. So here are the two things I'm aware that we're challenged by. The first is a desire for the board to have complete information in front of it when it makes a decision. And there is a provision that allows the victim or the district attorney, where an inmate has provided partial records, government records, DOC records, to request the board to order more records to make it complete. Let me make it clear, this does not give victims the right to have the parole board order those. It gives the victims the right to bring this disproportionate information problem to the attention of the board and gives them the opportunity to see whether there's a problem or not. It is completely within their discretion to determine whether they want to order that other information or not. It is not a right to discovery for the victim, but it provides a mechanism for the victim to be able to say, this record is lopsided or one-sided. can we bring this, allow them to bring it to the parole board's attention, and should the parole board wish to remedy it? The other provision that I understand we may have some disagreement about is the ability of a victim or DA to have a psychologist testify at a parole board hearing. It is quite possible presently in the parole board context for an inmate to hire a psychological evaluation, a private psychological evaluation, and present that to the board. In fact, I was involved in a case relatively recently where that happened. And that would be the only psychological information in front of the board. So this does not add a fiscal impact, because if a victim hired a psychologist, it would be at their expense. I don't see the negative of this, because all it does is provide the board with additional information. They don't have to spend any more money. And it provides a more complete picture, perhaps, of who the inmate is and whether they're a person who should receive whatever privilege the board is looking at giving them. So those are presently the disagreements, as I understand them, with the parole board. Finally, there was a provision that is being taken out, and I had talked to Joshua Nasby about how it got in the first place, because I didn't put it in there. And I want to point it out, because I'm not sure of the board's position on it at this time. Let me find that for you. But of course, when I came in front of the committee before, it was concerned that there be remedies. And in the initial draft, I was surprised to find that the language took out any remedy for the failure of the parole board to provide rights. And it did so, excuse me, I apologize. It did so by saying that the only rights, the only enforcement that could be possible, thank you, page 14, 4 to lines 4 to 8, and it's replicated in another place as well. Yeah. What I'm concerned about there is sub B, and it reads, except to the extent section 42 or 41, article 1 of the Oregon Constitution grants rights to and is enforceable by a victim in a proceeding conducted by the board, the failure of the board to notify the victim under paragraph A of this subsection, et cetera, does not affect the validity of the proceeding. Well, the Oregon Constitution provides no rights to victims in parole board context. Those are provided by statutes. So what this provision essentially does is strip a victim of any potential remedy for having their rights violated in front of the parole board. I conducted litigation against the parole board in a relatively high profile case where a trial court granted the remedy of mandamus to have the hearing redone because the victim was not provided with their rights under Oregon law, and was successful in that. And if this provision were to remain, that or any other remedy would be impossible. So let me check quickly. There is one concern of the local supervisory authority that remains, and that unfortunately we will have to modify in the language of the statute. We met with them today and we agree with the concern. And their concern has to do with those local formal hearings. They're fine notifying victims of those hearings, but they're concerned if they have to notify the district attorney of those hearings, that that will turn them into a hearing that requires levels of due process that will turn it from an administrative hearing essentially into a quasi-criminal hearing, have a significant fiscal impact concerning right to appointed counsel and other concerns they have around that. We're happy to modify the bill to address their concerns. Makes sense to me, but I just didn't hear that concern until about an hour before I walked in here today. So I'm happy to answer any questions, Chair Barker, members of the committee.
And where is that section you just spoke of?
Page 14.
No, the where you said that the rights.
Unfortunately, it is in it's in several places.
Oh, okay.
And the fix is not as simple as a deletion.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
Yep. I have it marked, and I can meet with Ledge Council quickly to resolve that.
All right. Okay. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 3, section 4, line 11 and 12, the right to retain a psychologist or psychiatrist to provide testimony. So who would be studied by this psychologist or psychiatrist?
Well, nobody would be studied. The psychologist could review the records available to the victim, and they could review the police reports, other things in the public record as well, and they could observe the hearing and observe the inmate during the hearing and provide an opinion on whether they thought the person was amenable to whatever it was the inmate was requesting or not, and testify generally about their psychiatric diagnosis or condition.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Additional questions? Council Taylor.
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, Mr. Ballouf, on section 2, page 2, it talks about post-conviction relief and the right to be heard or either orally or written at the hearing.
Yes.
Now, my understanding of post-conviction relief is it's usually that my lawyer wasn't very good, the police, the district attorney withheld evidence. So I'm just wondering, I would assume that the court may or may not hear their testimony based on relevance, because my assumption is that the victim is in there talking about that they were a victim. That wouldn't be relevant to the issue of whether my attorney was competent or not, would it?
That's correct. I think the victim would need to have information that pertain, when they spoke, they could be present and observe the hearing, but when they spoke, it would have to be pertinent to what the proceeding was about. I think that would happen in a minority of cases.
Chair Barker, Council Taylor, we have had, they are rare, but we have had situations where victims have been put through a deposition by the inmate and the inmate's attorney, and where they do land in court and are put in a position where they make statements. So.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Ballouf, I didn't quite catch what you said on relationship to page 14, subsection B. Is that in the provision in Article Section 142 or 43 in the Constitution right now? I'm trying to quickly read it, meaning that the right to be heard at a parole hearing?
No.
It's not.
Okay. There are no rights outside of direct criminal processes in the Oregon Constitution.
Okay, the failure of the victim.
So essentially what this does is negate the opportunity for remedy, although it does it in very oblique language.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, panel, and I want to thank you very much for the effort you've gone to meeting with other people to correct the original bill. It's important to bring one that's almost finished, so thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee.
Thanks very much.
These would be people who would be from the defense side right here. Pat Schrader is with the parole.
I'll call forward Brad Berry and Aaron Felton, please. And why don't you go ahead first, Mr. Berry?
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney, and I chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. I don't have a lot to add to this particular bill. I did want to offer that. I want to thank Mr. Ballouf for his efforts in this bill. I also want to thank Josh Nasby for a lot of time in working through what were some issues that we had about it, and both of them for working with us to resolve those issues. And the bill as it is now, really, I think, supports victims, allows them a place in the continued process, habeas corpus, post-conviction relief, and the like, and ODAA supports it.
Thank you very much. Mr. Felton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually have some written materials, which is just an outline of the testimony.
Staff will hand them out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I first of all want to start out by, I think that Professor Ballouf was perhaps used words that were a bit more negative to describe our conversations. Words like concern and disagreement and argument, I think, are inappropriate. Actually, our conversations were very collegial. He worked very hard and met many of the discussion points. And the bill you see today obviously is quite different than the one that first came before the committee. And so just the whole process was very, very positive. And I can say I think we're 80% of the way there. And so some of the areas that I think you described probably in darker terms than they are, because we are, there are more impacts and probably areas of discussion that we can continue to have and I think resolve. So the reason I studied law and not the classics is always that I mess the quotes up. I come to praise Caesar, not to bury him today. But to follow the outline, the board, I just come to you today, I came a bit out of breath, so I'm thankful for the opportunity to have a delay in my testimony, because I just came from a series of hearings with my fellow colleagues on the board in which we actually heard from victims of crimes. We had three hearings today involving murders in which victims, family members were there, and it was a real illustration of how our process works in terms of the notification of victims, in terms of working. We had attorneys on behalf of offenders there. So it really is the culmination, I dare say, of the very process that the sponsors of this bill are seeking to enact today. Because many of the goals and items that are in this bill already exist in statute. We are required to notify victims of hearings. We do that. We have a specialist, a full-time employee, who all she does is notify victims of upcoming hearings. She works with them. She accompanies them to hearings. One of the most powerful elements of a hearing is hearing the unvarnished testimony of victims. And many of these victims come to numerous hearings. Multiple times they've been before the board talking about the story and the impacts on their lives. So just hearing that raw testimony is powerful and effective for the board. I will tell you, we had one case today in which we had the son of a victim testifying. And there was he had a brother, and he said, "My brother's not here today. He's reached a point in his heart where he forgives the perpetrator. I cannot." And we do some of our hearings by telephone from some of the institutions which are far away. He said, "I want to reach to that telephone and beat this man, but my brother's reached a point where he can forgive." That was powerful. I had another hearing in which a victim said the perpetrator was pleading for forgiveness from the wife of a man who had, whose mother was the decedent. And she said at the end of it, and I was listening all along this hearing, and I thought, well, this is a powerful hearing. But at the very end, after he had pled for forgiveness, she said, "I don't want you to get out, but I forgive you." So that's the kind of raw testimony we get. So in terms of the goals of having victim involvement, I would dare say it's an effective thing, and it's working for the board in terms of having them there. So I was thinking about that on the way over. So my thoughts aren't real organized in terms of that, trying to assemble that. But that's some real data from the field, if you will, from the board. What I have for you, Mr. Chairman and members, are just impacts. I don't want to bring it to you as concerns, because we don't take a position on this bill. As policymakers, here are some things I'd just like for you to think about. As an administrator, I'm about the process. How will this affect the day-to-day business of the board and the agency that I'm running? Because we support the values expressed in this bill. Victims should be accorded dignity and respect and feel safe throughout the hearings process. And I work every day to figure out how can we accomplish that better, more efficiently, and more meaningfully. And as I said, by law, the victims are granted a significant place in the board's proceedings. I've mentioned the statutes which already exist. Victims have the right to attend board hearings. The DAs have the right to participate in the hearing. And frankly, that's very meaningful. We get a lot of data that we couldn't get because of the DAs who have prosecuted this case who participate. Frankly, Mr. Berry, I wish more counties would make that happen. We hear from the Multnomah County DA's office all the time, Marion County. But, you know, one of the best hearings we had was from the Klamath County DA. So I would really encourage you for some of the other counties in the DA's Association, participate in the hearings, because we hear about things that have happened in the past that we just don't know about. So I may make that pitch again at the conference this summer, but that is a font of information that would be helpful for us. And victims have the right by statute, several statutes, to express their views at the hearings, either orally or in writing already. The victims already have the right to receive the same files that we have. In fact, if they ask well enough in advance, they get the identical documents that we get from the Department of Corrections. The second, or the third bullet, rather, in the written materials are the parole hearings work group was established. My predecessor, Mr. Powers, oversaw that group, and a lot of the people who are in this room today participated in that process. A lot of our stakeholders did, and came to some common consensus goals and ideas, and some of those are set forth in the following bullets there, and we're working to implement those as well, and those are effective and meaningful for what we do. And you know, that's nothing that's ending. We can start that work group back again if perhaps between sessions some of the items which are proposed to you perhaps could be extended into more of a discussion if they were not something that the full legislature wanted to adopt in statute at the present time. These are certainly things we could take under a directive to go back into the work group concept and work on those as well. And I'm certainly open to that. As to the new language in the bill that Professor Ballouf discussed, the right to retain the psychologist or psychiatrist, as I think Representative Tomei indicated, really the impact was, I wasn't sure what the impact was. I wasn't sure how that would be implemented into board hearings. One of the elements, when you bring a professional involved, questioning something that another professional does in the process, I question. Board hearings are special. They are a unique process, as Professor Ballouf indicated, because they're not adversarial proceedings. They're not courtroom proceedings. They're more inquisitorial proceedings. In the best of sense, they're meant for the board to inquire of the witnesses, to inquire of the offender or the inmate. And so, you know, rules of evidence don't apply, and intentionally so. Legislature, you have given us the statutes on purpose to do it a certain way so the board can inquire of the parties. I dare say I am hesitant to change it into a process where the board may feel compelled to question the psychologist or a professional presented by a victim. I question what the impact of that may be. So I'd want to explore that a bit more with the sponsors as to what the impact of that may be. I'm going to go past the item marked Morrissey hearings because we've reached a good consensus with the sponsors there, and perhaps Mr. Schreiner from the local corrections departments will speak to that better, but I believe that is a sensible solution that's being discussed right now. The confidentiality of victim statements, I've written some there. Let me speak to that. That is simply a question that we need resolution from, whether it is from the legislature or the court. Ultimately, we need help. We have documents that we receive that are marked confidential because they're victims. In the past, we consider a lot of documents confidential. And whether they were victims or friends of victims or neighbors, it had been the past practice of the board to mark almost everything confidential. We've attempted to tailor that down, so we're focusing primarily on victims as the statute defines them. It is a real utility to the board. Now, here I am, I will say, I am advocating a bit. It is meaningful for the board to be able to trust that it is getting the unvarnished, uncensored feelings of victims in their opinions about what should happen or their opinions about what has happened to them. I have a concern that victims may feel intimidated. There may be fear of retaliation if that was shared with the offender. We had a situation in which we had some litigation around that, in which a judge essentially issued a protective order, in which he said that document may be shared with the offender's attorney, but may not be shared with the actual offender. Now, that works very well in a legal proceeding, however, in litigation. However, there's a concern that if a victim knew that, they may still yet feel a bit chilled by not understanding that, well, here's a third person. I'm still concerned that may go to the offender, even if it's their attorney. So we're sort of in a gray area there in support of the of the victim there. So we just need some clarity on that, because we anticipate there may be further litigation on that. So we just seek direction there. I know that perhaps those in the defense bar, and I, frankly, as an attorney, I understand. Believe me, I understand from a due process perspective, it just doesn't set right that as an inmate or as an attorney for an inmate, if you have all these documents that you can't see one that may be used against you, it just doesn't feel right. And I respect that feeling. But as a, again, as an administrator of this board, we just need resolution there. So we like that portion of the bill very much. Yet folks in the back have raised some concerns about the drafting there that I'd like some an opportunity to work with, because I think I might have been seeing it a bit narrowly in terms of our own needs. And so I'm open to discussion there. This issue Mr. Ballouf raised about requests to the Department of Corrections for additional information, I do have some concerns there, and because I believe the impact may be if a victim came and to us and said, we think there are additional documents that the Department of Corrections has that we need. Well, if we went to the Department of Corrections, one, I'm very confident that we get everything from the Department of Corrections that we need. But if there were additional documents that we went to the Department of Corrections and said, we need this, and they said, no, we're not giving them to you, I have no authority to compel them. The board has no authority to compel them, like a judge has the authority to compel documents in a discovery proceeding. Without that authority, that's a very hollow provision in this bill, and I fear it could create some hard feelings with victims, and it could also create a somewhat adversary relationship with the Department of Corrections. I believe it's inherent already in the law that if there are additional documents we would need, I can ask for them from the Department of Corrections, or the board can ask them. I'm sorry, I don't mean to use the imperial eye. I mean the board. And finally, the element that Professor Ballouf indicated about the language that's been removed in terms of the remedy, the concern that I raised in my written materials there is if a victim were not present, and the example I cited, if for some reason a victim were not present for whatever reason. Now, those of you who may have prosecuted domestic violence cases or been around that, there are a lot of reasons victims sometimes don't show up. I would hate for someone to view that, an offender or an inmate, as an opportunity for a hearing not to go forward, and perhaps use that as an opportunity to reach out to a victim to see as a means of stopping a hearing. At the Morrissey level, we have a lot of hearings where we can't find victims sometimes. Victims register with us, but they don't always keep up, keep their addresses up to date. If later, after we hold a hearing, a victim shows up and says, I wasn't notified, this provision at least allows the hearing's result to go unaffected. But that's an impact, potentially, of removing that language. But again, I'll finish up by saying these are impacts. The sponsors have been wonderful in showing good faith in working with us. I anticipate that these are all items we can have a discussion on, and I'll continue to do so. I'm open to that. So, Mr. Chairman, I have questions from the members.
Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next call, Bronson James, Gail Meyer, and Pat Schreiner. And we're starting to get a little crunch for time, so I would ask if you could. I'm not going to cut you off, though, since no everybody else got to talk as long as they did. But if you just keep that in mind, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bronson James. I'm an attorney. I practice in a wide variety of areas of post-conviction law. I'd like to talk to you today, I guess, primarily about the parole provision of this bill, and I'd also want to note at the beginning that I have sat on the parole advisory board and litigated some of the parole cases, particularly the mandamus cases that sort of brought this this proposed legislation about. And It is imperative to me, I think, one of the central tenets of any piece of legislation around the parole board is that it is in all of our interests, whatever side of litigation you're on, or certainly in the public interest side, that the board have the most full and accurate information before it that it can possibly get. And that's the position I've always taken sitting on the advisory board. It's the position I've taken in litigation. I don't think that any individual is served by hiding the ball. Rather, we want the board to know everything that it needs to know to perform its critical public safety function. So my concern, and first of all, I do want to note and commend Professor Ballou for the changes. I think this is a much better bill, unquestionably a much better bill than the last time when I came before this committee. And I also want to say that I think in the respect of everybody having the goal of having the board have the most complete and accurate information before it is a goal that's shared by myself, Professor Ballou, and Mr. Dole, who I'm privileged to serve on that advisory board with. My concern to this respect comes to mostly sections 4A and 4B, which is the nature of the record that the board would provide the victims. First, it's important to recognize that in release hearings, and there's a small number of release hearings anymore, and a lot of these are now becoming the most serious offenders that the board has, these are often individuals that have multiple victims involved. And so you may have 5, 6, 7 different victims all giving testimony to that board. They may not be in agreement about what should happen or what they want to happen to this particular individual. All too often, you may have family members who are also victims. So there's a sort of complex emotional drama that plays out there. My concern is that under 4A, where the board is obligated to provide victims the full record that it is considering, seems to necessarily implicate the various victim statements. And so it would seem to me that the board is then obligated under that section of the statute to provide victims' statements to the other victims as well, which is then contradicts 4B. So I think in that respect, the statute is internally inconsistent. And I agree with the Chair Felton that the statute needs some resolution there. And without question, the board and the litigants can benefit from this body's guidance into how the record is managed and who gets what. The other issue that I have some concern with, the board utilizes psychological records, properly so, to make very important public safety decisions. And those psychological evaluations, those testings, are only valid if the participant in that psychological testing is giving full, accurate, candid information. My concern is that if the psychological reports then disseminate out, and here what I'm particularly concerned with is that they are given out without any sort of protective order or without any sort of restriction on their further dissemination, that they then end up in the media. And I'm not a proponent of legislation via single case anecdote, but I, as this body is aware, in the Gilmore case, which sort of started everybody talking about these types of issues, really, I was the attorney for Mr. Gilmore, and I woke up one morning and I turned on my morning news, and there on the CBS Morning News were some very detailed portions of my client's psychological evaluation being discussed on national news. And that certainly engendered questions and comments to me by other prisoners about whether their psychological evaluations were going to end up in the Oregonian. My concern is not that the victims have access to this. I think that the victims probably should have access to this type of information. My only concern is that I don't want to so disseminate that information that we create the likelihood that future information is then going to be less valuable to the board, because it's not an evaluation to a psychologist, it's an evaluation of the psychologist and the media that will eventually get that evaluation. And so I would encourage this group to consider some sort of mechanism to protect that information so that it is fully disseminated to the close group of participants who most need and should know about it, but then protected from further dissemination so that we can ensure over the long term that these processes are effective to the public safety decision that the board is making. With that, I close my remarks, and I'm certainly open to questions.
Okay, does anybody have a question? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. James, for your always insightful testimony. I'm going to the protective order. I'm trying to think about what that might look like. I'm now thinking about what is the basis of, say, the judiciary, a circuit court's ability to issue a protective order. I don't believe it's a power endowed by legislative delegation. I think it's so much as its inherent authority of the court under our Constitution. What do you think we should do? Because you make a good point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, I wish I had a really good cut-and-dried solution.
That's tricky.
To you. I don't. I can tell you that I'm thinking about it, and I think you probably need a room full of smarter people than I to come to the resolution of it. But I agree with you that the protective order sort of draws its power traditionally from court common law. But I can also tell you that there have been numerous instances in history where the common law was then codified into some sort of statutory scheme. So I don't think, or at least off the cuff, I don't necessarily think that there is a prohibition to creating a statutory authority for an administrative body to issue a protective order, in theory. Now, that's a much bigger piece of legislation than we got here, and involves a whole other set of questions. But yeah, I think there is a solution that can be reached, and it's going to take some head scratching to figure out how we get there.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Meyer, or go ahead.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Pat Schreiner. I'm a district manager in Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, and I'm testifying on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors. You know, the mission and goal of community corrections is to eliminate additional victims. We continue to work collaboratively with the victims to protect them from further victimization when we're supervising offenders in the community. We believe this bill can strengthen this working relationship with victims. We are in support of notifying victims of contested hearings if the victim requests to be notified and furnishes a current address. We support allowing victims the ability to provide direct, uncensored statements to a hearings officer without fear of retribution or retaliation by an offender. We had a very positive and productive discussion this morning with Steve Dole, Doug Harkleroth, and Doug Baloof about our concerns in the bill. And our concerns where we were not able to support the bill had to do with Section 4 having to do with including the district attorney in the contested hearings process. And our concern was that this would have a negative impact on due process requirements, and the procedural changes would add complexity and costs. After having that discussion, we actually came to a very positive conclusion where those are the things that Doug Baloof talked to you about and raised the issue about, taking those pieces out and redrafting it. So we want to reserve the right to come back once we see that redrafting, because we believe the intent of the authors is very positive, and we believe that we can support it, but we do need to see that before we move forward. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
There's no questions, committee. Thank you, sir. Mrs. Myers.
Thank you, Your Honor. Co-Chair Wisnett and members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, there is consensus amongst all the parties here that there are certain elemental right that Mr. Harkle wrote, I think appropriately referred to as common courtesies, that should ought to be enacted. And that would be the rights of notice to a crime victim who wishes to be notified of any proceeding and an opportunity to be heard on issues relevant to those proceedings. And pretty much this bill, as it relates to criminal proceedings, post-conviction relief proceedings, and proceedings before the Psychiatric Review Board, codify those common courtesies of notice to the victim and an opportunity to be heard at those proceedings. But it does go much, much further than that in Section 4 as it relates to the hearings before the parole board and post-prison supervision. In effect, what this bill does do is it affords the victims greater procedural rights than are afforded the inmate whose liberty interests are at issue. So it gives the victim the right to be represented by a representative, also by asking and requesting that the district attorney appear. The inmate is entitled to be represented by a representative, but if he has, he or she has, one person present with her, him or her, then no other cannot call a witness. And so the victim is entitled to be represented, have the DA there, and call a witness, and have access to the defendant's hearing records that are at issue before the board. But the inmate does not have that reciprocal right, does not have the right to be represented and to call witnesses, nor does the defendant have the right to view the victim's statements. So we would submit that a basic elemental foundational principle of due process is at minimum parity, where some other person does not have greater procedural rights and privileges than the person whose own liberty interests are at stake. So we think that as to Section 4, it goes way beyond the common courtesies that were discussed. I think it's accurate to say this would be the first in the nation. This goes far beyond anything that I'm aware that any other state, certainly the federal system, does. And I think it would require a bigger, longer conversation to iron that out. With respect to Representative Barton's concerns about what to do if the victim is entitled to see, get copies, actual hard copies of psychological, psychiatric records of the inmate, what to do if there is inappropriate secondary use of that. Those things can go back, they can be scanned, they can be put on Facebook within a half an hour. So what to do about that? The problem is that even if the board were to issue a protective order, it doesn't have jurisdiction over a non-party to the proceeding. So by giving a non-party to the proceeding access to records, the tribunal has no authority to sanction that individual because that individual is a non-party. So I would submit to the committee here, these are issues that really do need to be ironed out, and I would hope that they would be a part of a greater and longer conversation than one that all parties to agree upon, which is that the victim should be entitled to notice if they request it and an opportunity to be heard. Thank you.
Thank you. Quick question, Mr. Bronson James. You've been through these hearings before. The psychiatric evaluation, is that done by the board?
Mr. Chair,
yes, I would say 90% of the
time they are. The board routinely orders psychological evaluations, and it has a stable of psychologists that it calls from. And the inmates is not obviously compelled to comply with the psychological evaluation, but I can tell you that a failure to comply with the psychological evaluation is certainly not the way to be granted release. So the inmate does. Very rarely an inmate will hire their own psychological evaluations. And I think, as probably any attorney will tell you, paid expert testimony probably isn't worth what you paid for it. And because it always comes with a certain slant towards it. And so I would say that both there's a financial reason why the inmates often don't hire their own psychological evaluators. And then I think that there's the reality that they realize that it may not be given as much weight as what is perceived as a neutral evaluator hired by the board.
So, James, so the question I have, if the victim, even though they're paying for it themselves, brings in another psychologist, a psychiatrist, and since, will that give rise to the right for the parolee to now request similar psychiatric help and that the state would have to pay for?
Mr. Chair, that counsel, that's an interesting question. My gut reaction to that is probably no.
Okay.
Clearly, we'd be in a different situation if the victim had a right to order its own psychological evaluation at state expense. Well, then we're totally into a different ballpark. But if it's simply a private psychological evaluation, I'm not necessarily sure that would give rise to any sort of right on the part of the inmate for their own private psychological evaluation at state expense. The other thing, though, that is worth considering is, again, going back to the notion of we want the board to have full and accurate and complete information. And there is a question, and I'm not a psychological expert. I would want to know this from a psychological expert. When the board contracts with its stable of psychologists, there is actual interviews, in-person interviews that are done. There's also quantifiable metric testing that's done of an individual. And the question then becomes, because obviously the victim is not going to be able to compel the inmate to participate in that type of second psychological evaluation, you know, against their will. So you're looking at essentially second, third-hand analysis of things that have already done records. The question becomes, what is the sort of probative value in that type of psychological evaluation? It may have some, so if it does, then by all means, I think, you know, the board should consider it if it's offered. But it's something to consider that I think the board, and I know the board has talked in the past about setting more standards and guidelines for what it considers a valid psychological evaluation, that might be something that should be considered.
Questions? Thank you very much. We will obviously, it needs a little more work to wrap it up. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3634 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3601.
Got it. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3601 requires implied consent hearings to be conducted telephonically, charges a $200 fee for requesting a hearing, authorizes waiver of fee if indigent, authorizes rulemaking establishing indigent criteria, allows any officer involved in an investigation to present evidence and argument at hearing instead of the officer who signed the citation, declares emergency effective on passage. There is a dash one amendment, and that basically makes the language consistent with hearings telephonically and also gets rid of the emergency clause.
Okay, thank you. Representative Stegman.
I'll try to be brief, Mr. Chair. Chair and members of the committee, Judy Stigler, Representative Judy Stigler, District 54. And I bring this to this body.
Just yell.
You have electric mat.
As a result of many conversations I've had over the last months with various law enforcement agencies, primary motivation behind this piece of legislation is to save money and to encourage efficiencies in the process. And the money-saving aspect of this, quite frankly, will impact not only the state, but counties and cities, locales as well. My second motivation, obviously, is to keep our police as much as possible doing the job that we hire them to do, which is to protect our communities. Originally, when I first started considering this, I looked at a variety of examples, specifically some examples out of Washington and a couple of other states where a paper shuffle is allowed. And in after conversations with some attorneys in my own locale, defense attorneys, as well as legislative counsel, I came to realize that, you know, this would essentially pose some due process issues on our part. So what I did was work with Ledge Council to move this to a situation where we would require these hearings to be either telephonic or by some other electronic means. I recognize that these are clearly administrative hearings, and which are narrow in their scope, and I believe that this method meets any due process test, and above all, it saves money. Additionally, there are a couple other changes that 3601 makes, and I will address the dash one amendments. Those were drafted with my consent and at my urging when I realized that an emergency clause had been left in, and then after further review by the Department of Motor Vehicles, they realized there were some language issues that needed to be changed to make it consistent with the fact that these would be done by some electronic means. So that's what our dash one amendments do, essentially. A couple of other things that this, besides the cost savings and efficiencies, it makes it clear in Section 2 that the police officer who appears, there's a provision where they can appear, somebody from the law enforcement can appear at these hearings on their own, and that particular person can be anybody that was any police officer involved in the investigation, as oftentimes in these situations you'll have a couple of different, and those of you who've worked in the field know it better than I, you know, a couple of police officers responding, the one who actually makes the stop and conducts the initial investigation, which is really the crux of this, and you may have somebody else who comes along who ultimately is the person who signs the citation but isn't the person who was actually involved in the initial stop, in the initial investigatory stage of this. So Section 2 talks about broadening that language. Additionally, let's see here. I wanted to emphasize here that we have not, I didn't change the discovery aspects of this. Part of the reason that we didn't want the emergency clause in there was to give DMV and all interested parties sufficient time to work out the logistics of process and procedure. I understand that this will cause some shift in how that occurs, but the discovery provisions were left unchanged as to what can be requested by subpoena, both in the way of witnesses as well as documents. And again, I guess what I would pose here is the fact that, you know, we're in a technological age, and I think part of what we do in government is to try to take advantage of the efficiencies provided by technology, and I think that this bill takes a step in that direction. I think it, again, it cuts costs. I got some figures from, just as an FYI, from the Department of Motor Vehicles, and if I can find them here, these are 2009, there were 4,459 requests made and 3,984 hearings actually conducted. I got some data from the Office of Administrative Hearings, and they figure if for the year 2008, which was the year they had the most recent figures, they would see cost savings of somewhere around $160,000, and that's in travel time per diem and motor pool costs. Additionally, my own City of Bend Police Department estimates somewhere between $5,000 and $7,000 that they would save in their local police department on these hearings. So you take that and you multiply it many times over. And again, I want to emphasize that, you know, part of my goal and objective here is to keep our police forces doing what they're supposed to be doing. And I'll just cite an example that was given to me by, we have in Central Oregon, down in the little tiny town of Gilchrist, two state police officers which are you know, housed there, and they cover a very long stretch of Highway 97. When one of those two, they rotate their shifts, when one of those two is off duty, the other one has the full responsibility. So in that example, an administrative hearing of this type would likely be held either in Klamath Falls or in Bend. So you have the travel time as well as the actual time involved in the hearing, and I did ask the question of the Administrative Hearings Office, and they allot, on average, 4 hours for these hearings. So you do the multiplication there. I guess I'd just like to close by saying that, originally I think I had folks really worried, and there was an article that appeared in the Bend Bulletin back on December 12th, and I was asked about this and asked about where I was going with it, and I said, I've had some, I'm not an unreasonable person, and I want to do this in the right way, and I came to realize very quickly that the paper shuffle just wasn't going to do the job, that there were these very legitimate due process issues. And at that time, one of the defense attorneys, the defense bar, was asked about the issue and said, well, if in fact I changed from paper to doing it telephonically, that was a good thing. And the quote actually is from Mr. Hinson. It says, I'm all in favor of using technology to attempt to reduce the cost of government. He said, adding that if she's modified her position to that extent, I salute her. And then just one final matter here, and that's with respect to the fee, because I know there's been some question about that. Again, one of the charges that we were given by the Speaker, if we had bills coming forward this session, it should be either cost neutral or cost savings. And this was done more in a spirit of a way that we could, help cover the costs of these administrative hearings. To meet equal protection requirements, there is a fee waiver that is attached to the $200 fee. And that's so that we're not putting anybody who is indigent at an unequal footing in this. But that was the primary reason behind that provision. So with that, I'll shut up.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to be, I'll call people forward. We are short of time. I'm going to have to limit people to 3 minutes. If somebody else says what you were going to say, please just let it go at that. I'll first call Trooper Iwai, Lieutenant Wilson, and Chuck Hayes.
Iwai.
Iwai? I'm sorry.
Can I have 1 minute at your discretion to discuss the dash two? With your permission, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to briefly discuss for the record the dash two amendment, which I requested be drawn. It is my understanding that the Chair has no intention of moving this bill today, so I appreciate your discretion in allowing me to discuss it just briefly for the record. First of all, I'd like to say I really appreciate Representative Stigler's efforts and focus on cost prevention and cost control. The dash two amendments, if they were adopted, I think would achieve many of those objectives, while still I think it would be an effective compromise, and it would essentially be that if a proponent paid the fee, then they would be entitled to a live testimony. Again, I thought that this would be a fair compromise balancing those two. I also note that Representative Garrett can't be with us today. He's busy taking a deposition. I just note parenthetically that he declined to take that deposition by telephone. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Please go ahead in any order and just identify yourself for the record. I'll raise my hand if you hit 3 minutes.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Michael Ewy. I'm a state trooper, and today I'm here representing the Oregon State Police Officers Association. I've been a member for the past 13 years. The association is in full support of House Bill 3601. Basically, it saves money. Overtime dollars spent, travel time, vehicle maintenance, and fuel. Currently, for the implied consent hearings, we talk about a peace officer who issued the citation. Okay. There are some cases where the citing officer may have served a limited role in the case and may not be the best officer to present evidence, examine, or cross-examine witnesses and to make arguments relating to the application of the statutes, the rules, and the facts of the case, the literal meaning of the statutes and the rules of the issue in the case, the admissibility of evidence, and the proper procedures to be used during the hearing. Multiple examples, they are such as another trooper processed the impaired driver. Another trooper stopped the impaired driver. Another trooper is not qualified to operate the Intoxizer 8000. Or a priority call, maybe the trooper gets a priority call and cannot process the DUI driver, such as a drug recognition expert call out, assisting another agency. Or a recruit trooper in training. There are several circumstances where you're going to have multiple people involved in a DUI case. But it's pretty specific and limited right now on who's going to provide testimony and testify on behalf of the state in implied consent hearings. The issue of the implied consent hearing is the suspension valid? Did they follow within the scope of the hearing? Did the trooper do his job or her job? It's pretty simple. This is an administrative matter. It is not a criminal issue. Of course, if when it does come to a criminal proceeding, all parties should be available for testimony to present all available facts. Additionally, troopers may travel up to 100 miles to appear before an implied consent hearing and spend more time traveling than they do testifying. By having the hearing monitored and conducted telephonically without question will save the OSP money and keep troopers active within their patrol zones and performing other essential duties. In 2008, OSP made 3,614 DUI arrests. 684 of those had implied consent hearing requests. In 2009, OSP made 3,727 DUI arrests with 787 implied consent hearing requests. Based upon my training and my experience, the time to do an implied consent hearing for me was anywhere between 45 minutes and 75 minutes or an hour and 15 minutes. Obviously, the training that's going to depend on the training experience of the officer. Did the petitioner show up by themselves? Are they represented by counsel? And how efficient is that trooper or officer as far as being able to testify within the scope of the hearing? Obviously, right now we are trying to save money. This will save money in many aspects. Unfortunately, the way that we track.
So, if you could just sum up real quick, please.
Basically, OSPOA, Oregon State Police Officers Association, is in support of House Bill 3601. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Trooper.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Chuck Hayes, the chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI. I'm here today in support of 3601, House Bill 3601, and specifically Section 2, because as you've heard from Senior Trooper EY here, we are concerned about all police officers as well as troopers, and the complexity of DUI investigations anymore actually do require and sometimes lead into multiple officers being involved in the investigation from start to finish. So with that in mind, as Senior Trooper EY has mentioned, many times the arresting officer, the one who signs that citation, he or she may not be able to make the hearing. And so if that happens, well, then that arresting officer, that agency, the state actually looks upon other witnesses that can come in and testify to present that evidence for that hearing. And without maybe the arresting officer being there for some reason or another, well, then that may not happen. And my prior to being retired from the Oregon State Police, that was one thing that I was concerned about as a supervisor, was sending officers from the Albany Patrol Office up to Salem to go to an implied consent hearing, and sometimes the trooper did not make it to the hearing because of a crash or some other investigation that took his or her time before they arrived. And that trooper was the only witness for that hearing. So that day, that hearing did not result in the evidence being processed or heard that day because of the trooper not making it. So those were concerns that all supervisors have and all agencies have, so therefore we are in support of 3601.
Thank you. Sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lieutenant Ethan Wilson with the Patrol Services Division with the Oregon State Police. I'll be brief. While the Oregon State Police takes no official position on the bill, we do agree with the factual information as presented by Mr. Hayes and Senior Trooper EY. The department does believe that the potential efficiencies and the beneficial aspects of the bill merit the committee's further consideration. And that's all I had.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next I'll call Kevin Campbell, John Powell, and Brad Berry, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I've been on record before the committee on this bill before. We support the bill. I mentioned before that we have officers that often have to travel a long distance to appear for these hearings. The example I gave at a previous hearing was between leaving Ontario and having to go to Baker City for these administrative hearings. That is replicated in other areas around the state. For that reason and the other reasons that have been mentioned today, we support the bill.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, I'm Brad Berry, Yamhill County District Attorney, and I chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. We are in support of 3601. I should be candid in mentioning that district attorneys don't have much of a role typically in these hearings, but I do note that we are familiar with issues that have come up with them. This particular proposal would save money. It allows for electronic communications, telephone or video phone, and I just point out that we currently use that frequently in court. With defendants in court, we'll waive individuals having to appear in person in court, and it's common practice. I think overall, this really just brings us into the 21st century and utilizing techniques that will both save money, allow for due process to take place, and the like. The last thing I would mention is that this implied consent procedure has been in place for a very long time now, and I think it is time for us to take a look at the processes that are in place, as well as when we assure both offenders a right to be heard. I think we also need to have processes that are appropriately limited and avoid abuse of the system, which, at least as we're told by officers who attend these hearings, occurs with some frequency, as well as when we find out at trial certain things have gone on. So I welcome the opportunity here to at least have our first run at looking at these hearings and hope to have a broader conversation in the future.
Thank you.
Chairman, my name is John Powell, representing Oregon's 36 county sheriffs, and we support House Bill 3601 for the reasons that have been stated and have nothing to add. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It may have been a better question for the other panel. I really applaud Representative Stigler's efforts to make not only our troopers' lives more manageable, but also our public safety expenditures more targeted at, you know, doing good stuff. Do we have any thoughts about or any information about how much money we might be able to save from doing this? I know it's sort of hard to gather. We're not going to be able to get a hard number, but sort of a range. I mean, I know it can be, you know, thousands of dollars in a given locality. Do we have any rough estimates about what that might look like?
Chair Barker, Representative Smith, you were looking at me, and I'm probably the least able to answer that question. I have seen the figures that Representative Stigler mentioned about just right off the top, $160,000 saved in travel costs for the year 2008. And I would guess, since the report from OSP was that they did more implied consent hearings in 2009 than they did in 2008, I would suggest that it would save more money. I think a principal thing, and what's really hard to determine, is the overtime cost. Yeah. Which may be saved from the various agencies in sending officers to these particular hearings. And in part why that's difficult is if you have a callback, a three-hour minimum on overtime, there may not be a savings if it's there. However, some of these hearings, I do know, go 4 and 5 hours at a time, and there may be savings that you don't, in addition to that, have travel within the particular jurisdiction, or if you have an officer who may have been out of jurisdiction when they made a particular arrest, there would be significant savings on overtime costs.
Cool, thanks.
Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Ms. Meyer, why don't you just come up by yourself, if you would, please.
And identify yourself for the record again.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. The committee might recall back in January there was a hearing on the bill. And we had a short period of time between seeing the bill and the hearing, and in that period of time, I conferred with a few members, and we took a position at the hearing as having no opposition. Since then, I can inform the committee that a sizable number of the members who do practice DUII law have been very upset with that position and also have grave concerns about the bill. So I simply wanted to acknowledge and explain to the committee that there is that variance here between the members and the committee. We are attempting to target more precisely the bills that we do take a stand on. And so in this instance, I think it's appropriate for the members to express their interests in this proceeding.
Thank you very much. Tom McClellan, please. Barker, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the administrator with the DMV, with the Department of Transportation. I will keep this short as well.
Thank you.
Just
point of information, these hearings are conducted very quickly. Individuals have 10 days in order to request the hearing. The hearing has to be held within 30 days after the arrest. So it's a very efficient process, very quick, has to be done. There were two or three points that we raised when we took a look at the bill. I believe the Dash 1 amendment will take care of these, but let me just quickly run through those. The bill as drafted says it takes effect upon passage. We do need some time to prepare for this change. One of those changes is rulemaking. In a 90-day period, that's going to be probably emergency rules followed by more formal administrative rules. So we'll have to do some of the public input process after the quick emergency rules are done, because that's very, very fast to have it effective at sunny day after the session. Section 4 has to do with when it takes effect also, the hearing should take effect on those arrests that take place after the effective date of the hearing because of the notice concerns. So we'll make sure that's built into the notice of rights and consequences and the ICCR that's used by the officer. A point of information also is that adding the application fee for the hearing will require individuals to mail their hearing request or deliver that to the DMV office here in Salem. So it may be a little extra time that they're going to have to build into their process. A majority of the requests for hearings come to us by fax. So the payment piece of it is a new piece that may cause some people to have to do some things a little differently in order to get that request in. We will develop procedures to determine if the person is eligible for a waiver of that fee based on the standards that are in the bill. So we will put that in place during that 90-day period after the bill has been approved.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Sorry.
Yeah, maybe this is just a Cameron. Point of clarification from my understanding. Why is there an emergency clause on the bill?
It's been removed.
Well, in the Dash 1 amendments, Representative Cameron, it is removed.
Okay, so then when would the bill officially take place?
90 days.
90 days after this bill is enacted.
If I may, Mr. Chair, was this bill in 2009? Was it here in 2009 anywhere?
No.
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. McClellan. Just real quick, I just wanted to verify that the numbers I had recited regarding the numbers of filings in 2009 was correct, to the best of your knowledge.
Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, those figures are correct for 2009. We have seen a reduction in the last 3 or 4 months based on one particular case that's affected this whole program, Machuca case.
Yeah.
So we have seen a reduction overall, but the figures you cited, approximately 4,500 per year of requests and about 4,000 per year we forward on to hearings to hold the hearing.
And follow up, that's sort of the average over the last several years.
That's about what it has averaged. It's in the 300 to 350 per month that we forward on for an implied consent hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, call up Mr. Hingson. Mr. I think it's Nydick and Reynolds.
And again, I have a time running, so about 3 minutes, please. We're running out of time. And you can go in any order. Just please identify yourself for the record.
Good. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is John Henry Hingson. I'm a criminal defense lawyer in Oregon City. My name has already been mentioned in this record, and I know that every one of you has been quoted in the media, and sometimes we're quoted accurately, sometimes we're quoted in context, sometimes out of context. I would like to put into context what my comments were. I was asked if I supported a bill that would change the method of conducting DMV hearings to have it done by paper, and I was asked if I supported the bill proposed by the Representative Stiegler, and I said only if she would agree to have a concomitant amendment to the Oregon Government Ethics Commission so that if you get accused of misconduct, your trial is conducted on paper. I'm against zapiscas and dossiers for conducting truth-finding hearings. In the past, the Department of Motor Vehicles has indeed conducted DMV hearings by telephone. I've had them. I've had witnesses conduct testify by telephone. They didn't have statutory or Oregon administrative rule authority to do it. I've had video conference testimony without statutory authority. And under some circumstances, it works just fine. But freedom of choice is something I believe that is extremely important here. Mr. Chair, other members of the committee, some of you have been trained in how to interrogate. If you wanted to find out the truth about whether a crime had been committed, would you choose to interrogate a suspect by telephone or see him in person? The answer is obvious. If you're going to make legislative findings of fact based upon conflicting testimony here, do you want to see the people that come testify to determine what the truth is, or do you want to just take it by telephone? A number of years ago, I was defending a person accused of attempted murder in Pendleton, Oregon. The prosecutor had a videotape of a witness whom he led, and when he said things that would require follow-up questions, he had blinders on and didn't follow up. When I started that trial, I brought in a lead rope and picked it up out of my huge steamer trunk. Anybody know what this is? It's a lead rope. I picked up some blinders. Anybody know what these are? And some cowboy with a can of tobacco in his back pocket said, yeah, those are blinders. At the end of the two-week trial, I said, there is a magic horse called Veritas, meaning truth. It's a white stallion. All you have to do is slap him on the rump and let him run free, and he'll always find the truth. But there are two rules when you're using Veritas to find the truth. Never put blinders on him, and don't lead him. By the same token here, there are going to come times when witnesses will testify, he said and she said, and there's going to need to be a credibility determination. Some of you have been trained in how to be a witness in a courtroom. Eye contact with the person who is the fact finder is important. When a person's eyes are shifting back and forth.
3 minutes.
But go ahead, you can finish up.
Okay, my only point here is that there should be freedom of choice, and the handcuffs or the blinders should not be put onto the person who conducts the hearing. From the Office of Administrative Hearings, the administrative law judge should be able to have that option, particularly when the petitioner pays the money. The petitioner should have the option.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Neidig. I'm a criminal defense attorney in Portland. I do a lot of DUIIs, and I represent a lot of people who are not eligible for court-appointed and of marginal means. This is going to impose a hardship on those folks, and we're going to see a reduction in the number of DMV hearings. I think that you should encourage DMV hearings, not discourage them. We've heard testimony that they will save money at one end, but they will cost more money at the other end. That's in the courtroom. The DMV hearing is a perfect vehicle for weeding out bad cases. A lot of our clients aren't the best reporters. They don't remember a lot of stuff that goes on. And a DMV hearing is a real awakening and provides a lot of information. And a lot of cases that we get incomplete reports. And if we only go on those, we think that we have a good case and that we should take this to trial, or that there's a motion to suppress that will prevail. At these DMV hearings, we get to see all the reports, get to cross-examine the police officer, do it in person, see how they react, see how they answer questions. We get to fill in all the gaps that we don't get just from a few pieces of paper. So that we can go back to our clients, or our clients are there and they can see, they can have their eyes opened by what the testimony is, and how the officer testifies, and we weed out a lot of cases. A lot of these cases would go to courtrooms, require juries, would require judges, would require more time of these officers than a simple DMV hearing. In the back end, you're going to lose a lot more money through the courts and through the cases that we think are winnable, or actually we don't know unless we have an opportunity to do a full-blown in-person DMV hearing.
Hey, thank you. Questions, anybody? Please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is McDaniel Reynolds. I am a criminal defense attorney now. I used to be a DA. In fact, my office used to be right across from the chairman in the Southeast Precinct when he was a lieutenant there. I'd like to give you a little anecdote, a case that I won. I just got to be a ruling on earlier this week or late last week. It represented a kid. I don't represent usually the high rollers. I represent folks that are just good people that maybe found themselves in a way that they shouldn't have. He, 22, 23 years old, he's a mechanic. His livelihood depends on him being able to drive the cars that he fixes. He contacted me. We talked about the DMV process. We talked about the facts that they're uphill odds. It's difficult to win a DMV hearing, but this was very important to him. We had the hearing. He borrowed money to hire me. We won the hearing because the officer said he refused that breath test. Well, he didn't refuse. He had a medical condition, it's acid reflux, and probably everybody's heard of, and a stressful situation that acted up. And there was a new trooper, a good trooper, who did the best he could, but he didn't know what to do in that situation because here was this person that wanted to take the breath test, but he kept having a medical problem that prevented it. So the officer eventually, the trooper eventually hit the refusal button because he didn't know what else to do. That's not the trooper's fault. It's not my client's fault. But my client was facing a one-year suspension. He didn't have the money to toss out $200 to start this off. We're talking about real people here, too, and I want to make sure that you don't lose that. I don't support 3601. I don't support dash 1. Dash 2 I think I can live with, so I sure would appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your time coming down. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
In the old days.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I have a question.
I'm sorry.
For the last witness. So what about that particular hearing wouldn't have happened over the telephone?
My client was a very nervous person, and the physical demeanor of him at that hearing was pretty important. Ironically, at one point I asked the judge to take a look at my client's shirt, because he had pitted out that shirt and sweated down halfway aside. Okay, it was kind of an indication that he's a very nervous person, very high strung. When I was talking with that trooper back and forth, things that you gain from nonverbal communication helped me understand what questions to ask next, helped me understand how to get myself into that situation, really understand what happened that night. It's those nonverbal cues that would be lost without that in-person hearing.
Thank you very much. And I have one more. Mr. Korski, please. Yeah. I got them. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Mr. Powers. And Mr. Kahn. Thought we were through. But
Mr. Kahn's on the sheet.
Okay, yeah, Mr. Kahn was on a different sheet. So please go ahead and just identify yourself for the record. And
ladies and gentlemen, Mark Korski. I also am a criminal defense lawyer. I'm in Portland. I echo the comments of Mr. Hinkson, a tough act to follow, and Mr. Reynolds. I would just like to say that as a proponent of technology, I don't think that it's the right answer for these kind of hearings for the reasons that we've already heard. There's no substitute for being able to actually sit and have the judge see the witnesses and judge the witnesses personally and in person and have the lawyer have that same opportunity to do those things. I would mention that this hearing is important to our clients, for many of them who face a suspension ranging from 90 days to 3 years of their licenses, and many of them that's their livelihood. As you all know, you lose this hearing and they can go to trial and they could win a trial and still their license remains suspended. That's their only chance, and it needs to be the best chance that they could have, the most fair chance that they could have, and it needs to take place in person. That's all I really have to say.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kenneth Kahn, and I'm a partner in Kahn & Epperson. We're a criminal defense firm up in Portland. I've practiced as a criminal lawyer for 20 years, and a large part of my practice is about DUIs. I, like Mr. Hinkson, have attended telephonic hearings and also, in an experimental program, attended hearings involving video conferencing as well as the DMV hearing as we currently have it. And I've had an opportunity to see what works and what doesn't work in these kinds of hearings. First of all, what works? What works is what we have right now. We have the opportunity to meet the witnesses face-to-face to look at their demeanor. But more important, what happens is that the police officer will bring a police report to the hearing. We will never have seen that hearing because from the time of arrest to the time of the hearing is very short, often about 10 or 15 days. We can't get through the normal discovery processes to get access to the information to see what's there. So when the officer brings the report, we see it for the very first time and we have a chance to look at it. At that hearing, we also bring exhibits. We bring photographs. We bring maps. We may ask the officer to put a diagram on the board to explain what happened in terms of the stop and where my client was and where he was and what the relationships were. We play audio recordings that were made, sometimes audio recordings that were made left at voicemail or on a home answering machine that shows what an individual's sobriety was, whether or not their speech was slurred. We also have other kinds of exhibits, such as the individual themselves opening up their shirt. Remember, this is just a few days from arrest. Having an individual opening up their shirt and showing a giant seatbelt mark that goes from this side down here that clearly indicates that they were in the passenger seat at the time of the crash and that the wrong person got arrested. If you take that kind of information and you put it in a telephonic setting, here's what happens. First, as a practical matter, I've done these telephonic hearings, and what happens is that you're required to fax the kinds of exhibits that you want to offer in advance of the hearing. That gives the people an opportunity to look at them. The kinds of hearings that we've done telephonically typically have to do with no insurance issues and those kinds of paper hearings, which are kind of straightforward, where you're just dealing with the administrative law judge and the attorney. So it's very easy to fax things back and forth when you've got two parties. When you add another person involved, you're faxing information from them to DMV, then DMV to the other person. In situations there was a program where Dwight Apple, the past head of DMV, used teleconferencing. They used it as an experimental program with OSP for 6 months. It showed four different people on the telephones on the screen at one time. There was always a failure. At the end of 6 months, they scrapped the program. Ontario officers were given the opportunity to appear telephonically. They preferred to drive to Baker City. They preferred it. In terms of one other thing I wanted to say in closing, we heard from officers saying that they're at a disadvantage because the other officers aren't there. Under Cole versus MVD, they are allowed to present police reports into evidence even though they are hearsay. It fills in the blanks. I'm opposed to 3601.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Powers.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you. John Powers, I'm an attorney in Portland. I've been doing this for 32 years. Before that, I was a DA for 5 years. And the chairman and I have been back and forth on both sides of the fence. But the reason why I'm opposed to 3601 is that it's not broken. We don't need to fix it. Might need to be strengthened a little bit, and parts of this proposal do strengthen it. I don't mind, personally, recommending to my clients to pay $200 if we can have that in live hearing. But it's necessary to have that hearing for the purposes that for the reasons you've already heard. And I want to just center on a couple. Mr. Neidig talked about money. That is so true. My emphasis is on recovery when I'm dealing with clients. And a lot of people come into this with denial. And you know, you can read a police report, which oftentimes is woefully inadequate or sometimes embellishes and exaggerates, and it doesn't give the full story. And a client is entrenched in his innocence. But with that face-to-face confrontation with the officer, it can be cathartic. They can change. They can cut through that denial. I mean, I listened with interest with the man from the parole board talked about unvarnished, uncensored testimony being powerful and persuasive from crime victims, and he wants those people in front of the board. I want to have the officers in front of my clients so that they don't want to go to trial and persist in this. Because when you do get into that trial, you get into, what, 2, 3, 4 setovers, don't we? And the officers are all getting paid 4 hours for that on overtime. So now we have a lot more expense. You're robbing Peter to pay Paul and Mary and a few other groups. The other thing I'm concerned about is the quality of the hearing. Anybody who's been on a cell phone and been talking with somebody, you know you talk over each other, you cut through. My wife is a court reporter. We get transcripts of these hearings. The difficulty with the hearing judges, with the administrative law judges listening and people talking over each other and making a transcript is just, it's going to be catastrophic. It is difficult to imagine how you are ever going to get a clean record, which is going to take longer than the hearings take now in person. I think strengthen it, but don't try to fix it. It's not broken. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Your Honor, may I add one more thing?
Yes. If you don't call me Your Honor, you can't.
I want you to imagine a situation where you found out that you've been arrested for DUII, but you were never arrested for DUII. Someone stole your identity and used it. You decide to request a hearing to challenge this. You're at the end of one phone, and you don't have a fax machine because you can't afford it. At the other end of the other line is an officer who can't see you and an administrative law judge who can't see either of one of you. Do you want to have a judge say, do you want to have an officer say, I didn't arrest that person, it was somebody else? Or are you going to worry about a judge saying, you know, I don't know who's at the end of the other line. You know, the officer said he arrested this fellow. Suddenly you end up with a 1-year license suspension for a breath test refusal, and that's just because they can't see you and you can't see them, and that's just not right.
Thank you very much, Mr. or Representative Smith.
Thanks, Chair. And I'm not sure if there's another panel coming up that might be able
there
to.
There isn't.
There is not?
There's not.
Okay. Then. So we have the dash twos as one option. Have we given any thought to other potential amendment options that would address that sort of situation or have it rather than just pay a fee? I mean, you know, the pay a fee thing is neat, but what if somebody can't afford the fee? Well, maybe they're indigent. What about somebody who can, you know, maybe pay the fee, maybe not? Any other amendment options like a for cause, you know, for there, hopefully they're smart enough to say, yeah, I'd really like one and there's a real reason. Have we considered any other amendment options?
There's always the situation where you're dealing with the innocent party. You know, I wasn't the driver. I drank after I was driving. I didn't refuse. We heard about medical reasons. Some other guy did it. The machine malfunctioned or my rights were violated. And so it's going to cost you money to go in and say those things. And for Oregonians who are above the food stamp line, which is what the threshold is in 3601, they're going to have to make a choice between spending that extra $200 or spending something else. And it's going to be the most expensive $200 they never were able to afford.
So, Mr. Chair, I know we're behind on time, and I think there's probably a revenue note or something. I don't think we're moving it out today.
We're not moving it today.
Right. So I have that question sort of the room and to us to think about it, you know, what options we might have.
Okay, thank you. And I want to thank you, the panel, and I want to thank everybody for keeping their
testimony. Good hearing.
I'm sorry. For keeping their testimony very brief and concise. It was very helpful.
Thank you.
Anybody else? We need to make sure we carry over these bills
okay.
to work with them.
Okay. Let's not close the public hearing.
All right. Yeah.
Close the public hearing on 3601, and we'll be carrying these bills over. We'll be posting this.
Thank you. Yep. We have. Yeah.